I was not guilty. It was a wicked conspiracy. Or to use a more up-to-date idiom, I was framed.
We present Cecil Parker as Admiral Lord Cochrane in A Matter of Speculation by Henry Cecil, based by the author on his book of the same name. A Matter of Speculation.
My name is Thomas Cochrane. I was born in 1775, and so my spirit is only 10 years from its double century. My body died in 1860, when it was 85. You would find its remains in Westminster Abbey if you opened the tomb. I wouldn't have been buried there now, would I, if I'd been guilty, but I tell you I was not guilty. Please forgive the emphasis. But when I think of the cruel degradation which I suffered, even as a spirit, I get angry. Now, you may ask why I should still worry, since I died loaded with honors and was buried in the place reserved for kings and mighty men. The answer is this. My case was never reheard. Year after year, I demanded a rehearing, always in vain. Now, you shall rehear it. You shall be convinced of my innocence. On the 8th of June, 1814, I was charged, together with a foreigner called Beringer, my uncle Cochrane Johnston, a man named Richard Butt, and various other men, with conspiring to spread false rumors of the death of Napoleon and the defeat of the French in order to cause a temporary increase in the price of government securities. It was alleged that we'd bought such securities a few days before and that we'd sold them at a profit on the day of the rumors. Now, you shall judge whether I was the sort of man to commit such a crime. Anyway, I only made £2,470. But first, what sort of man was I? I'll get my friend and fellow spirit, Sir Francis Burdett, to tell you something about me.
Thomas Lord Cochrane was the eldest son and heir of the 9th Earl of Dundonald. He entered the Navy when he was 17 and greatly distinguished himself at sea. In 1809, at the early age of 34, he was awarded the KCB for his brilliance and gallantry in action against the French. I make bold to say that he was as brave an officer as ever served in an English ship.
Thank you, Francis. As it would have been difficult for me to say all that.
I hadn't finished.
Pray continue.
In war, his dashing courage was, if possible, surpassed by the fertility and ingenuity of device by which he deceived the enemy. He was a past master of ruse and stratagem, and he never knew when he was beaten. He has been well described as Cochrane the Dauntless.
Thank you. I claim no credit for this. One is as one is born.
He was a politician, too, and in 1806 he entered Parliament as member for Honiton.
Well, I do claim some credit for that. In those days, bribery was rife, and there was no secret ballot. I'd put up in 1805 and been soundly defeated. Well, it wasn't surprising. My opponent had offered £5 per vote, but my principles wouldn't allow me to pay one penny. I soon found out what the position was. It can be summed up in the language of one of the voters I canvassed.
You need not ask me, my lord, who I votes for. I always votes for Mr. Most.
I made my plans accordingly. At the end of the 1805 election, when, as I said, I was soundly defeated and received only a few votes, I sent the town crier around Honiton.
Oh, yes! Oh, yes! Oh, yes! A statement by me Lord Cochrane, the defeated candidate. All those honest men who voted for him may repair to his agent, who will pay them not £5, but 10 guineas.
No one could call this bribery. I was paying for my defeat. Nothing wrong in that. But at the election in 1806, I stood again as candidate. Well, thought the good citizens of Honiton, if Lord Cochrane can pay 10 guineas to be defeated, what will he not pay to be elected? And so, I was triumphant. After the result had been declared, my agent was besieged with voters demanding their reward.
Honest citizens
citizens of Honiton for returning him as their member.
Hooray!
He hopes that he will represent them faithfully in the new parliament.
Hooray!
As for the request for payment made by some voters, he thinks there must have been some mistake. Such payments might be thought to be bribery. And Lord Cochrane would never descend to such dishonest practices to secure his election. He will, however, give to all those who voted for him his grateful thanks and not one farthing more.
I was quite pleased with that. But on the whole, I didn't find I was very popular at Honiton. So not long afterwards, I managed to secure election as one of the members for Westminster. My dear friend Sir Francis was the other.
And he was as bold in the House of Commons as he was at sea. I have seen him speak for an hour and a half with no supporters except me. And as it was usually for the underdog he spoke, you can imagine how he was hated by the establishment of those days.
Well, it wasn't surprising that I had enemies. Well, that is the reward of men who keep their consciences clear and stand up for the right.
Valor and toil was his family motto, and to those words he added boldness and resource. Boldness in all things. Even, I was going to say, in defeat, but he would never recognize defeat. He was most dangerous when defeat seemed inevitable.
Well, I've always believed that if possible, attack is the best method of defense.
And how often was he proved right, fighting his way out of impossible situations, careless of his own life or limbs?
Thank you, Francis. It was only in the end that I was appreciated, when I was dead.
How true.
I rescued Chile and Peru from the Spaniards and Brazil from the Portuguese. And what did I get for it? A few statues in Chile and a few words of thanks. Well, you can't cash statues and you can't line your pocketbook with thanks. It cost me £20,000 or more to give those countries their freedom, and all they paid me was a paltry £6,000. But I must say, I did enjoy the war.
He won it by unsurpassed bravery and unsurpassed audacity. How many times did you sail under false colors?
Whenever it was necessary. It was great fun. I always enjoyed pulling people's legs. But we must get back to my trial.
Oh, tell them first about your capture of Maranham. He took this heavily fortified province single-handed with one ship only. It was pure bluff.
Well, some people will believe anything. I sailed into the harbor under Portuguese colors, and a messenger was sent out to us. I explained to him who we really were, and said that I was in command of a large squadron, and had come ahead as I was the fastest ship. I sent him back with a letter addressed to the commander of the province. In it I told him that I had huge forces in my command, but should much prefer to free Marne peacefully. I offered him quite reasonable terms for capitulation.
And they capitulated. When they asked where the rest of the fleet was, it was too late. And this was only an example of what I might call, without, I hope, offense to my noble friend, what I might call his bounce and bravery.
Yes, well now that you know the sort of man I was, let me tell you about this outrageous trial when my enemies combined to crush me. I hope I'm not exaggerating when I say it was one of the most disgraceful episodes in English history. Would you call that an exaggeration, Francis?
It's putting it very mildly, Thomas. They treated you like a common criminal.
To circulate...
Eh?
To circulate false news with intent to raise the price of any commodity is, by the law of England, a crime.
That, if you want to know, was the voice of Mr. Gurney, counsel for the prosecution. But all I can say is that no one has ever been charged with such a crime before. In my opinion, it was just a case of one set of stock jobbers trying to raise the price of stocks at the expense of another set of stock jobbers. I mean, the losers naturally being indignant at the successful hoax. But Lord Ellenborough, the Lord Chief Justice, before whom the case was tried, didn't agree with that. Well, this is not surprising, considering that he was at the time of my trial a member of the Cabinet, which I'd been regularly attacking in Parliament. What he said...
Forgive my interrupting, Thomas, but Lord Ellenborough was not a member of the Cabinet at the time of your trial.
Wasn't he? Well, he was a member of some Cabinet, I know.
Oh, he was indeed, but it was a different government. I hope you don't mind my correcting you.
My dear Francis, of course not. I'm most grateful. I don't want to make any false points. In any event, Lord Ellenborough was just as biased against me as if he had been a member of the cabinet.
This is an indictment for an offense of great malignity and mischief.
That's how he began his summing up. But I mustn't anticipate that little gem of malice. You want to know what the evidence was against me, and you shall hear it. I have a complete record of the trial. As it takes up over 500 pages, I won't read all of it to you. But you may take it, I shan't leave out anything in my favor. I mean, anything against me. It's lucky that I have this record, because as a matter of fact, I wasn't present at the time. Well, you may think that's strange. So indeed it is. It was another of the prosecution's wicked devices to secure my conviction. Had I been tried at the Old Bailey, I should have had to appear in the dock. So the prosecution asked for the case to be heard in the King's Bench, where I was not obliged to appear. I was so conscious of my innocence that I didn't bother to turn up. I've no doubt that that was what the prosecution banked on. They could tell all the lies they wanted without my being able to defend myself.
Of course, you were entitled to be there, Thomas.
Don't quibble, Francis. I was entitled to be there, of course. But the prosecution guessed that I wouldn't be there if I didn't have to be. Why should an innocent man bother about it? I tell you, there wasn't a scrap of evidence against me. It was not only the government that trumped up the charges, but the Stock Exchange Committee. I'd beaten them at their own game, and they weren't going to have that. Oh, dear, no. Now, let's see what happened at my trial. One of the men charged with me was this foreign fellow, De Beringer. He was a shocking chap, really. But he was a damn fine shot and a bit of an inventor. I was an inventor myself, as a matter of fact. Huh? Oh, well, that's another story. To return to De Beringer, I do not altogether disagree with what Mr. Gurney, the prosecutor, said about that ruffian.
De Beringer bore a principal part in the conspiracy and was a fit person to be selected for the purpose. Though a foreigner, he had resided long in this country. He could pass very well for an officer. He had been for 14 months a prisoner for debt and would be a convenient man to convey away after the crime, as he would prefer residence in any other country since his creditors resided in this. As far as this case is concerned, he first appeared upon the scene at Dover a little after midnight on Sunday the 20th of February in the year of grace 1814.
Open up, landlord! Open up!
Oh, this is a fine time to knock. It's late.
Not too late for my business.
Oh, I'm sorry, sir. I didn't see your uniform. Won't you come inside?
Thank you.
What is your business, sir? If I may make so bold.
The best business this country has heard for 20 years. I have just landed on the beach bringing dispatches from France.
Dispatches, sir? About the war?
What else?
Might I know, sir, you have good news?
The best you've ever heard. Napoleon is dead, and the French defeated.
Oh.
But I should not have said that. My lips are sealed. Bring me pen, ink, and paper. I must write to the Admiral at Deal and inform him. And get me a post chaise and four, one that will move.
At once, sir. Wake up! Wake up, woman! The war is won!
The war is won!
You heard the war is won!
They say the war is won!
The war is won!
Tell me, do you see in court the man who spread this news?
Yes, he's sitting down there.
The accused. De Beringer, you mean?
Yes, very so, my lord.
And that is the man you saw getting out of a hackney coach?
Yes.
What was he wearing?
Oh, a grey military coat, a scarlet uniform with a star on his heart, and a silver medal suspended from his neck.
Take a look at these bedraggled clothes. They were found in the Thames near to De Beringer's lodging. If they were clean and new, what would you say?
They're very like.
Have you any doubt as to the colour of the uniform?
It was red.
Well, of course it was red. I've never said there wasn't a plot. Of course, De Beringer was in it. My uncle Cochrane Johnston was in it. Richard Buck was in it, and all the other small fry. But it wasn't them the government wanted. They wanted me. So they called dozens of witnesses to prove De Beringer was the man.
Members of the jury, when De Beringer arrived in London from Dover, he changed into a hackney coach and drove straight to number 13, Green Street, Mayfair. This was the house of Lord Cochrane, a house which his lordship had only taken 3 days before. De Beringer must have been on fairly intimate terms with Lord Cochrane to know his new address.
I told you, I knew the man.
And Lord Cochrane very kindly provided De Beringer with a civilian hat and coat. You may imagine, members of the jury, that the man who had been spreading the rumors would not wish to be identified when the rumors proved to be false. So he wanted a quick change of clothing. At number 13 Green Street, he got it.
I can only say that he was in the green uniform of the sharpshooters when he came to me. He said that if he went back to his debtor's lodgings in it, it might excite suspicion. I just obliged the fellow, that's all. Where is the conspiracy there?
Lord Cochrane must indeed be a very unlucky man, if he is innocent of any conspiracy. 12 days before the fraud, he owned no government stock at all. By the day of the fraud, however, he had contracted to buy altogether no less than £139,000 worth. Settling day was on the 23rd of February. The false rumors were circulated on the 21st of February. And early on that date, Lord Cochrane sold out all he had at a profit of £2,470. It is indeed a very unfortunate coincidence that he'd happened to buy all that stock just before the fraud, that he should sell it that very day, and that the man who spread the false rumor should happen to call on him earlier on the same day and be supplied by Lord Cochrane with a civilian hat and coat.
I sold out early. If I'd held on, I could have made a much greater profit.
Then why didn't you hold on?
No, Lord Cochrane, you knew the rumors were false and that the price might drop at any moment, so you sold early. And, be it noted, you employed the same stockbroker that was used by your uncle and Mr. Butt. And that stockbroker had an office rented for him by your uncle just outside the stock exchange only 2 days before the fraud. Altogether, the three of you bought and sold £1.5 million worth of government stock between the 8th and the 21st of February.
Why shouldn't I indulge in a little gambling? And who told you that De Beringer came to my house? I did. Why should I do that if I were guilty?
You must have thought he could be proved anyway by your servants and others.
Well, if I hadn't told you that De Beringer called on me, you'd have said that I was holding it back. When I do tell you, you say I do it with an ulterior motive.
Poor Lord Cochrane. All was maligned and misunderstood. And what bad luck he had. De Beringer ran away and there was a hue and cry after him. He was travelling on a false name and obviously seeking to go abroad. But he was caught. Now he needed money to make his escape. And when he was arrested, he had money on him.
Members of the jury, fortune indeed must have a loathing for Lord Cochrane if he is innocent. I can prove that some of the notes found on the arrested man had been in Lord Cochrane's possession a few days before. How many more coincidences do you want before you say, these are no coincidences, Lord Cochrane was in the swindle with the others?
I was not. Don't think that you can browbeat me like you and Lord Ellenborough browbeat the jury. I have more respect for that scoundrel Lamarchand, who tried to blackmail me, than I have for you.
The prosecution did not seek to rely on Lamarchand's evidence.
Then why call him?
On consideration, I don't think we should have done so.
In other words, any stick was good enough to beat me with, however dirty.
He came to the stock exchange with evidence.
And what evidence?
At the time, we couldn't tell why he gave it.
Then let me tell you why he gave it. First of all, he wrote to me on the 6th of April, 1814. A smooth, smooth letter.
My lord, although I have not the honor of your acquaintance, I beg leave to solicit an interview with your lordship for the purpose of explaining a conversation I had with Mr. De Beringer a few days prior to the hoax of the 21st of February, and which must be interesting to you. If your lordship will condescend to appoint an hour, I will not fail to attend punctually at your house or elsewhere.
He delivered that letter to my house, and because I didn't answer immediately, he wrote again, not quite so smoothly.
I had the honor yesterday to address your lordship for the purpose of giving information you're not aware of. And knowing my letter was duly delivered to your lordship personally, I beg to say that I now feel justified from your silent contempt and defiance thereof to make my information public.
He underlined those last words.
Disgraceful. You should have kicked him out of the house.
I agree.
Then why didn't you? Instead, you wrote a letter. Would you have any objection to reading it?
I am ashamed of nothing I have done and nothing I have written.
Then pray read it.
All right. I wrote, circumstanced as I am and attacked by scoundrels of all descriptions.
Forgive me interrupting, but who were all these scoundrels who were attacking you?
Well, the whole lot of you.
I find this rather hard to follow, but pray continue.
Circumstanced as I am and attacked by scoundrels of all descriptions, I should have hoped that a gentleman of your understanding might have discovered some better reason than that of silent contempt to account for the delay in answering a note.
An odd sort of letter to write to a man you didn't know who was obviously threatening you? Unless, of course, you had a guilty conscience.
I've never had a guilty conscience.
Of course, if you've never had a conscience at all, that would be true.
That is mere abuse.
I apologize. Shall we hear Mr. Lamarchant's reply?
I ask your lordship's pardon for my letter of yesterday, which was written under the supposition of being treated with silent contempt. I have the honor now to enclose a statement of what I know relative to the 21st of February, and I also now declare solemnly that no power or consideration shall ever induce me to come forward as evidence against you. If my conduct meets your approbation, can I ask you for a reciprocal favor in the shape of a temporary loan? I'm just appointed to a situation of about 1,200 a year, but for the moment I'm in the greatest distress with a large family. Necessity has driven me to ask your lordship's favor. Whether granted or not, be assured of my keeping my oath of secrecy.
The statement which Lamarchant enclosed referred to interviews which Lamarchant had had with De Beringer, in which he claimed that De Beringer had told him that he was now in a good financial position as a result of services which he'd rendered to Lord Cochrane and his uncle, which had enabled them to make large sums on the stock exchange.
I didn't answer that letter.
I don't blame you. And Lamarchant soon forgot his pledge of secrecy. Strange that a man of his kind should have been offered a government appointment abroad. But he never got it, after what Lord Ellenborough said.
He is a person whom the government might do very well in letting ride at anchor here, without going abroad.
We could well have dispensed with him. But apart from his evidence and that of two other witnesses, you don't and couldn't dispute the rest of the evidence.
What about those two witnesses?
Of those two witnesses, one said De Beringer was in red when he changed into the Hackney coach, and the other that he was in red when he called on you.
Foul perjurers.
We will hear them in a moment or two and see. But before we listen to their evidence, let me remind you that your counsel virtually admitted that De Beringer appeared at your house in red. He said that you were mistaken when you said the uniform was green.
My counsel let me down. He should have made no such admission.
And you called one of your servants who saw De Beringer at your house on the 21st of February. He could have said the uniform was green if it had been, but your counsel didn't ask him, and for good reason. In the original brief to counsel, it was stated that De Beringer was wearing red when he called on you.
I tell you, my lawyers let me down.
Everyone's out of step except you, apparently. Even your own lawyers. Not to mention poor little William Crane, the foul perjurer. You claim that De Beringer must have changed from the red uniform into the sharpshooter's green on his journey from Dover to your house in London. You said that he carried a case in which he could have put the uniform he was not wearing.
Yes, indeed. And after the trial, I produced affidavits of several people to say that he arrived at my house in green.
You did, and you claimed then, as you claim now, that Crane, the Hackney coach driver, was a witness procured by the other side to commit perjury. A pity, then, that you didn't prosecute him for perjury.
It's not my business to prosecute people.
Indeed not, but you did prosecute one witness, didn't you?
Well, what of it?
You prosecuted the man called Davidson, who, though called by the prosecution, gave evidence in your favor. De Beringer's defense was that he was not the man from Dover, and he called evidence to prove that he was elsewhere at the time. You know now, and you knew then, that the alibi was false. Do you recollect what Lord Ellenborough said?
If the evidence produced by the prosecution is not sufficient to establish that De Beringer was the man, I am at a loss to say by what description or quantity of testimony such a matter can be satisfactorily proved at a trial.
Well, I should have thought that was for the jury to say.
Well, they said it.
Only after having been told by the judge to do so.
Nevertheless, De Beringer was the man for all his attempt at an alibi. You have to admit that.
Well, he was the man, yes, but I didn't conspire with him.
To return to Davidson, the man you prosecuted. He gave evidence for the prosecution, mark you, to suggest that De Beringer was in London when in fact he was in Dover.
Now, if de Beringer wasn't the man from Dover, you were bound to be acquitted. Yet you prosecuted Davidson for helping you. Why? You don't answer. Let me do it for you. You hoped you could get a witness for the prosecution convicted of perjury, so that you could say that you'd been convicted on perjured evidence. Unfortunately for your little plan, Davidson was acquitted.
Well, I don't see what that has to do with it. I wasn't guilty.
But if you prosecuted Davidson, why not the wicked Crane? It was the keystone of your case that Crane committed perjury. You didn't prosecute him, yet you did prosecute Davidson. Now let's hear the perjured evidence of this witness suborned to commit perjury by a corrupt prosecution.
You are William Thomas Crane?
Yes.
Do you drive a hackney coach?
Yes.
On the 21st of February, do you remember taking up a fare at the Marsh Gate?
Yes.
Where did the fare come from?
Either by Dartford Post, Chaise and Four.
Where were you directed to drive to?
To Grosvenor Square. When I reached Grosvenor Square, the gentleman told me to drive to 13 Green Street. He got out there.
Did you hear for whom he asked?
Colonel or a captain or somebody. Oh, I didn't hear the name, but they said he was gone to breakfast in Great Cumberland Street.
That is where Lord Cochrane's uncle lived, members of the jury, and where Lord Cochrane had, in fact, gone. Well, what did the gentleman say then?
Well, the gentleman asked if he could write a note to him.
Did he go in?
Yes.
Were you discharged then?
Yes. The gentleman gave me 4 shillings before he went in, and I said I hoped he'd give me another shilling.
Is that what you actually said? You hoped he'd give you another shilling?
Well, we have our own way of saying these things. The gentleman took out a portmanteau that he had and a sword and went in. Then he came out into the passage and gave me another shilling.
Apparently your way of saying these things was effective. Well, what sort of a portmanteau was it?
A small leather one. Big enough to wrap a coat in.
Well, what sort of leather?
Black leather was as well as I can recollect.
Have you seen that person since you drove him to Green Street that morning?
Well, I saw him at Mr. Wood's house.
Mr. Wood is a messenger from the aliens office who arrested de Beringer, my lord.
Thank you, Mr. Adolphus.
Do you see the man you drove to Green Street in court?
Oh, I think that's the gentleman there.
Were you of the same opinion when you saw him at Mr. Wood's?
Yes, but he adorned himself very much by his dress.
Thank you.
That was the whole of this wicked perjurer's evidence in chief. This was the man whom the government and the stock exchange had suborned to commit perjury. Lord Cochrane, can you point to one false word in the whole of that evidence?
Read the cross-examination.
I will. But if I may say so, when wicked conspirators get together to persuade a man to tell a story to bolster up their case, he usually tells those lies when he first goes into the witness box.
Well, this time he waited. He bided his time.
William Crane, a 17-year-old hackney coach driver, bided his time? Almost Machiavellian.
I tell you, he waited.
He even helped your case by volunteering that de Beringer carried a bag in which he could have put his red coat. He needn't have said that. I wonder why he did. You haven't paid him to, I suppose.
That's a lie.
It wasn't a lie. It was a question. I just wonder, if you'd paid him to say that de Beringer carried a case, and then he'd slipped in a bit about his wearing a red uniform, that would have accounted for your anger and for your not being able to prosecute him. However, I agree, that's surmise. Now, let's listen to Crane's cross-examination by Mr. Richardson, de Beringer's counsel.
You went to Mr. Wood's house for the purpose of identifying this man.
I did.
De Beringer was pointed out there as being the person in custody.
No, I met the gentleman coming up the stairs.
And you thought you saw a resemblance?
Yes, I thought he was something like the same gentleman that I carried.
You do not pretend to be able to recollect every person you carry in your hackney coach every day.
No. But when this gentleman got out of Green Street, I saw that he had a red coat underneath his greatcoat.
At the Marsh Gate, where he changed coaches, you did not open the door of your vehicle to him?
No.
The waterman did that?
Yes.
But when he got out in Green Street, you opened the carriage door to him?
I did.
And he paid you and passed into the house?
Yes, he did.
What was the colour of his coat?
Brown greatcoat with a cape with lace to it.
Did you not describe the coat before as a kind of brown coat?
No, brown grey.
That was the substance of Crane's evidence. Does this 17-year-old boy sound like a wicked perjurer? Why did he not positively identify de Beringer if he was paid to get you convicted? Why did he not put de Beringer's red uniform in the forefront of his evidence?
I'm not well acquainted with the ways of perjurers. So can't answer that question.
Yes, the only other witness whose evidence you challenged was Bartholomew the Waterman. Let's hear what he had to say.
Are you a waterman attending a stand of coaches at the Marsh Gate?
I am.
Do you remember the witness Crane having a hackney coach at the stand on the 21st of February?
I do.
Did you see a gentleman get into it?
I did.
Well, go on.
He skipped out of the Dartford coach into the hackney carriage.
Did you open the door and let the step down for him?
Yes.
How was the gentleman dressed?
He had a kind of brown cap on and a dark military sort of coat.
What had he under the greatcoat?
A scarlet coat.
Did you see anything on the scarlet coat?
I only took notice of the lace upon it.
Do you think you would know the gentleman again?
I do not know.
Look around you and see if you can see anyone.
I do not see that I can recollect him. Only seen him that half minute.
Look at that gentleman who is stooping down to write, and see whether you think it was like him.
Yes, I do, upon my word. But I only saw him for about half a minute.
This Lord Cochrane is the other perjurer bribed by the prosecution to get you convicted. Why did he not refer to the star and medal on the scarlet coat? Why did he not identify de Berenger sooner and more certainly?
I repeat, the ways of perjurers are not known to me. I don't move in those circles.
The prosecution called 53 witnesses, excluding Le Marchant, and you dispute 5 words in the evidence of one witness and 3 words in the evidence of another. For the rest, the whole of the evidence was admittedly true. Do you still say you were not guilty?
Most assuredly. And subsequent history proved me so.
It did nothing of the kind. At any rate, the jury convicted you.
Well, they couldn't help it. Anyway, the jury was packed.
Your uncle was present when the jurymen were chosen and objected to none.
My uncle was a fool.
He was also guilty and fled after your conviction.
His conviction was justified, mine was not.
There was more evidence against you than against him.
There was no evidence against me worthy of the name.
Even your old friend Sir Francis Burdett said he would have convicted you if de Berenger had appeared before you in scarlet.
But he didn't. He was in green. And Lord Edinburgh deliberately disregarded the question.
You have already had the animal hunted home, and now you have his skin found and produced as it was taken out of the river, cut to pieces.
What's wrong with that? What's wrong with what I said? I take up de Berenger at Dover as I would a bale of goods. I have delivered him from hand to hand from Dover to London. I have delivered him into the house of Lord Cochrane, and I have Lord Cochrane's receipt acknowledging delivery.
Very picturesque. But not in the scarlet uniform.
Which your eminent counsel, who subsequently became a chief justice, did not dispute.
Well, don't talk to me of chief justices. Lord Ellenborough was enough for me. I remember the way he passed sentence.
He didn't pass sentence on you. It was one of the other judges, Mr. Justice LeBlanc, who sentenced you.
It is painful for the court to observe that among those who stand for judgment, there should be anyone who, by reason of his rank, situation, and every attribute held honorable among mankind, ought not to have been connected with persons of the description of those with whom he has been connected. This is a conspiracy of the greatest magnitude and of the most prejudicial effect to the community. The sentence, therefore, is that you, Sir Thomas Cochrane, commonly called Lord Cochrane, do pay a fine of £1,000. And that you be imprisoned for 12 calendar months, and that you be set in and upon the pillory opposite the Royal Exchange for 1 hour between 12 noon and 2 in the afternoon.
Silence! Silence!
I remember that sentence only too well. I think perhaps it was the only occasion in my life when, for the moment, hope seemed to fail me. I read later what the diarist Crabb Robinson wrote. It may well have been true.
The sentence of the pillory was passed against Lord Cochrane, de Berenger, and Butt. The severity of this sentence has turned public opinion in favor of his lordship, and they who first commiserated with him afterwards began to think him innocent. When the sentence was passed, he stood without color in his face, his eyes staring and without expression, and left court like a man stupefied. I have since heard that he recovered his spirits in prison. This disgraceful punishment will, without doubt, be remitted to him.
I little thought at that moment that I should be buried in Westminster Abbey. But Francis Burdett and some of my friends stood by me. I've never forgotten it, Francis.
What are friends for, Thomas? Only to acclaim victories? They're more important to cheer and defeat. But Lord Cochrane could not be down for long. Within half an hour, he had recovered his spirits and was fighting back. He wrote to the Speaker of the House of Commons protesting his innocence. Did he not, Mr. Gurley?
He did indeed, Sir Francis. He never stopped protesting his innocence. He did so before sentence and after sentence. He acted on the principle that if you say a thing often enough, people may believe it. His speech before sentence didn't please de Berenger. As they were being removed from the court, de Berenger was heard to say to Lord Cochrane,
"Don't you, coward, a liar! You know you are as guilty as any other!"
I treated that remark with the contempt it deserved. And there were many who believed in my innocence.
That is true, but why? Crab Robinson records,
"I found his friends strongly impressed with Lord Cochrane's innocence. And his cause is taken up by kind-hearted sentimentalists who cannot believe that a brave officer of noble family could so vehemently protest his innocence if he were guilty. But be he guilty or innocent, it is certain that the current of favor now running towards him is a suggestion of sentiment, not reason."
I venture to disagree. Even in the House of Commons, which expelled me, 44 members voted in my favor. I made a speech in my defense.
You did indeed. So uncontrolled that Hansard was full of dots and asterisks.
Well, if you had been wrongly convicted and sentenced to the pillory and imprisonment, you too might have used strong language. Well, I admit that I did. It was none too strong.
You said you were tried by a packed jury.
I was.
And you agree that your counsel admitted in his speech that de Berenger came to you in a red coat?
Exactly. Because of the mistake in the brief.
Your friend, Sir Francis Burdett, agrees that if de Berenger came to you in the red coat, and you sent him away with a civilian hat and coat, you must have been guilty.
What of it?
Well, then, even an unpacked jury must have convicted you. Why should this jury be packed?
Well, to be on the safe side. The rascals in the government and on the stock exchange wanted my blood. I'd attacked them so often. They were determined to get me.
What a stroke of luck for your enemies that a fraud was perpetrated on the 21st of February. And at the trial, you appeared plainly guilty. They had to do nothing except wait for the ripe apple to drop. It was you who did their work for them. It was you who bought the stock a few days before the fraud. It was you who sold it on that day. It was you who handed to de Berenger a civilian hat and coat. It was partly your money which was found on de Berenger. It was you who failed to attend court. And it was your solicitors and counsel who, you say, made a mess of it.
It is easy to sneer at a man when he's down.
But you're not down now. And I certainly admire the way you rose again.
Not before I'd spent a year rotting in jail.
Not rotting.
Well, I tell you, I was not guilty. That's why I escaped and ran to the House of Commons.
I've always wondered why you did that. You had only 3 more months to serve, and you were bound to be caught.
It was the consciousness of innocence which made it so difficult for me to remain caged up. And I felt that if I could address the House more calmly, they'd come round to my point of view and have my conviction set aside.
It was certainly a daring thing to do. I gather you hurt yourself in the course of your escape.
Yes, yes, confoundedly. The escape itself wasn't too difficult. And it wasn't the first time I'd escaped from a prison. There were some farcical proceedings in Malta, where I was locked up for going into the judges' rooms and removing a list of fees from a lavatory.
From a lavatory?
Well, didn't you know? Yes. When naval officers became entitled to prize money, the legal officials were entitled to make certain charges. They always charged exorbitant fees far beyond those that were authorized. I wanted to get hold of the list of authorized fees and found it in the lavatory. I must say I was surprised they hadn't gone one further and put it down the closet. Well, they locked me up, and eventually I had to escape as my men were getting impatient. I used much the same method in the Marshalsea. I had a bit of rope smuggled into the prison. With this, I let myself down from an unbarred window. I then had the outer spiked wall to scale. I threw a running noose over it, hauled myself up, and sat on one of the spikes. Now, that wasn't very comfortable. If once again you doubt my word, you should try it sometime.
No, I'll take your word on that.
Thank you. I then secured the rope to one of the spikes, but unfortunately, as I was letting myself down, it broke and I fell. I hurt myself quite badly. However, I managed to get away and 10 days later presented myself in the House of Commons.
But they wouldn't hear you.
It was disgraceful. The House allowed one of its own members to be arrested in the chamber.
But you've been expelled.
Ah, yes, but after my expulsion, there was a fresh election, and I was re-elected. They couldn't very well expel me again. I must say my constituency has stood by me.
I remember now. Didn't the other candidates stand down, and weren't you elected unopposed?
That is so. I'd have been elected anyway. At any rate, my constituents believed in my innocence. Well, the House wouldn't listen to me, and I was carted away like an escaped bullet to serve my final 3 months. And most unpleasant it was. I wrote on the £1,000 note with which I paid my fine. My health having suffered by long and close confinement, and my oppressors being resolved to deprive me of property or life, I submit to robbery to protect myself from murder in the hope that I shall live to bring the delinquents to justice.
I'm still at a loss to know who the delinquents were.
I repeat, Mr. Gurney, that it was a whole damn lot of
you. Just say these things. I was framed, you say. After you've said it often enough, people begin to believe you.
Nearly all the books agree with me.
True enough. But most authors don't know the facts. But let's come back to the books.
The books?
Yes, the books. The first you wrote yourself. Did you tell the truth?
Of course. I've never told anything else. It's you who tell all the lies.
Come, come, Lord Cochrane.
And I pray don't say come, come to me, sir.
I'm not surprised you're touchy. Your book was full of lies. Listen to this. This is your language. You read it.
Huh. One most material point connected with the trial cannot be overlooked. Lord Ellenborough was not only Chief Justice, but at the same time a Cabinet Minister. He came hot foot from a Cabinet meeting to decide on my fate. The fate of a person the government hated and was determined to suppress.
Well, that wasn't true, was it? Your trial was in 1814. Lord Ellenborough was a member of the Cabinet of a different government in 1806.
Well, I got the dates wrong, that's all.
And then you wrote that you were denied a new trial because before sentence, your uncle and another man ran away.
That was most certainly true, and I can prove it. Look at pages 532 to 534 of the shorthand notes.
I thought you'd say that.
Well, doesn't it show that they refused even to listen to my application for a new trial because of the technicality that all the accused were not before the court?
It does.
Well, then, where's the lie there?
You are a remarkable man, Lord Cochrane.
Yes, I prefer your insults to your praise, sir. At least you mean to be rude.
But I do think you're remarkable. You'd bluff your way through anything. It's perfectly true that your first application for a new trial was refused on technical grounds. But later, you were permitted to apply for a new trial. And you were heard in full.
I might have saved my breath.
At least it was untrue to say that you were not allowed to apply for a new trial. Yet writer after writer has repeated this misstatement.
I am not responsible for what other people write.
But in this case, you are. They repeated your misstatement.
They should have looked it up.
Then why didn't you look it up?
What I wrote was literally true.
Yes, but you also suppressed the truth, which is a more effective way of lying.
Well, if I'd forgotten something, how can you call it lying?
How you can have forgotten making a 3,000-word speech, I do not know.
There are many things you do not know. But there's one thing that I do know, and I've never forgotten, that I was not guilty.
I think you almost believe it by now.
And so do many others.
I grant you that, and I'll tell you why. Because they don't know half the story, and haven't had the chance to hear the different stories you tell to suit your case. When the motion to expel you from the House was upheld, you said that if you were guilty, you fully deserved the punishment.
Well, what's wrong with that?
Nothing. But don't you remember saying on another occasion that it was just a trumpery hoax and wasn't a crime at all?
No one has ever called it a crime before.
Then why should it be deserving of severe punishment?
Oh, you lawyers would twist anything.
Well, untwist this one for me, if you will. Do you remember a Mr. McCrae who was one of your co-defendants?
A rascal. He meant nothing to me.
But with a sense of humor, don't you think?
This is no laughing matter.
Agreed, but in that case, why did you let your uncle forward McCrae's letter to the Stock Exchange?
What letter?
Have you forgotten that, too? Before your arrest, your uncle sent on a letter to the Stock Exchange Committee, which he said Mr. McCrae had authorized him to send. It read as follows.
Sir, I authorized the bearer of this note to state to you that I am prepared to lay before the public the names of the persons who planned and carried into effect the late hoax, provided you accede to the terms which my friend will lay before you.
Well, what's that to do with me?
Your uncle sent that note with a letter of his own. In it, he said,
Mr. McCrae is willing to disclose the names of the principals concerned in the late hoax on being paid the sum of £10,000 on the conviction of the offenders.
A modest little sum, £10,000. Your uncle continued.
I am happy to say that there seems now a reasonable prospect of discovering the authors of this hoax, and I cannot evince my anxious wish to promote such discovery more than by assuring you that I am ready to contribute liberally towards the above sum.
That was very noble of your uncle, but the poor man got no reply. So he wrote again and sent the letter by hand.
I have to request that you will be good enough to inform me what are the intentions of the Stock Exchange on the subject of the letter I addressed to you relative to the proposal of Mr. McRae. Lord Cochrane, Mr. Butt, and myself are willing to subscribe £1,000 each in aid of the £10,000 required by Mr. McRae. The bearer waits your answer, which, to prevent any mistake, I hope you will find the time to commit to writing.
Your poor uncle. By that time, I can well imagine he must have been almost frantic. Ah.
Surely he should be back by now. What a time the man takes! Ah, at last. Give me the answer, man.
There was none, sir.
No letter?
None, sir.
Nothing at all?
Nothing, sir.
Oh, God.
That was on the 18th of April, Lord Cochrane. But your uncle didn't have to wait in suspense much longer. He was charged with conspiracy 2 days later.
What has this to do with me?
That's what I want to know. Why did you agree to pay £1,000 to this rascal if you were innocent?
To find the names of the guilty, of course.
In the same way, I suppose, that you offered to see the blackmailer, Le Marchant.
Le Marchant had nothing to do with McRae.
I should have thought that both these incidents showed that you, like your uncle, were trying to avoid being prosecuted.
My uncle was guilty. I was not. But who would not want to avoid a prosecution? I knew nothing of McRae at the time.
Well, you certainly did later. McRae was almost as irrepressible as your lordship. Just before the motion to expel you, a petition was presented by McRae through his MP. I should think that this must have been the only occasion when the House received a petition from an escaped criminal on the run. This time he didn't ask for £10,000, but stated that he wanted to come to your rescue. Did you have anything to do with that?
Certainly not. I had no connection with the man either then or at any other time.
Well, then I think it was very good of him. He asked to be allowed to be examined at the bar of the House. Unfortunately, he didn't give an address where he could be found, so the House refused to listen to his petition.
What's that got to do with me?
Only that I find it odd that the man to whom you offered to pay £1,000 should want to come to your aid without knowing anything about it.
Well, if it is odd, it does nothing to suggest my guilt.
Perhaps not, but there are so many odd things about your lordship's case.
Such as?
I hoped you'd ask that. You swore that when De Berenger called at your house on the day of the fraud, you were in a small factory in the city.
That was true?
No doubt. And that there you received a note. That, again, I believe to be true.
Very good of you.
Not at all. A note summoning you back to your house in handwriting which you couldn't read.
True.
No, my lord. Untrue. The note was, in fact, sent by De Berenger, as you have long since admitted.
But I couldn't recognize the handwriting.
No doubt you preferred to say you couldn't. I suggest you recognized the writing well enough.
I did not.
Only 4 days previously, you had written a letter to De Berenger saying, your papers are very clear, as are all writings which come from your pen. How came it, then, that on the 21st of February you could not recognize his handwriting?
Well, he probably wrote it differently.
As are all writings which come from your pen.
Yes, you said that before.
I thought I'd remind you of it. De Berenger says that in the note he complained at your not being at home and said he wouldn't leave the house until you returned.
You'd accept the word of a self-confessed swindler before mine?
I must confess that I see no distinction between you, except that he had the grace to admit his guilt. But let me remind you of another oddity. You swore that you returned to the house at once because you thought the writer of the note had brought news of your brother, who was abroad.
Well, he was abroad.
Of course he was. The virtue of your lordship's lies is that they're always based on some degree of truth. You swore that you thought your brother might have had an accident, and so you hastened home to see the man.
I thought he'd come about my brother.
Did you indeed? Did you think that some accident might have befallen him? Let's see. When your application for a new trial was fully heard, you put in evidence to show that your brother had indeed been taken ill. Not an accident, but had been taken ill. You told the court that before the day of the fraud, you had received a letter from your brother telling you of this illness. You did not bring this letter to court. Instead, you produced the affidavit of the surgeon who treated your brother. Do you remember what Lord Ellenborough had to say?
This affidavit does not show that Lord Cochrane was in possession of his brother's letter previous to the morning of the 21st of February.
My brother's affidavit states that he wrote to me early in the month, and I received his letter on the Friday previous to the fraud.
That was capable of being verified. But the original letter is not annexed to the affidavit.
Well, I had no wish to bring my brother's letter before a court of justice.
Pretty thin, don't you think, on reflection, Malone?
Not in the least.
Why didn't you ask leave to go and get your brother's letter when the point arose?
They wouldn't have given me leave. They were determined to ruin me.
But why didn't you swear that your brother was ill if you'd already heard about his illness? The truth, of course, is that the letter was from de Beringer, and you knew that very well.
It is not the truth.
Why didn't you like this idea of bringing your brother's letter before the court? You didn't bring it because you knew that the letter would have proved that you hadn't had it before the 21st of February.
It would have proved nothing of the sort.
Well, where is the letter? Why didn't you produce it with the one you wrote subsequently to Lord Ellenborough? It would have been a perfect piece of evidence. You could have reminded him that they'd refused to believe you about your learning of your brother's illness, and here was the letter which proved them wrong and you right. Why didn't you do that?
The letter to Lord Ellenborough was long enough as it was. I couldn't put everything into it.
It's odd that whenever one gets a chance of testing your story, the evidence is missing. I cannot for the life of me think why you've never produced that letter.
Well, there are no doubt a lot of things that you can't think of, but that doesn't mean that I was guilty. I was not. I was framed.
Well, you've certainly satisfied a lot of people that you were.
Three Lord Chancellors among them. Not the easiest people to mislead, I should imagine.
They shouldn't be. But one of them, Lord Campbell, swallowed your story about not being allowed to apply for a new trial without checking up on it.
Is that my fault?
Certainly. By putting a misleading heading to one of the chapters in your autobiography, you persuaded at least three authors to say that you subsequently prosecuted one of the witnesses against you and secured a conviction. You know well enough that the only man you prosecuted was Davidson, and he was acquitted.
The judge was unfair.
Chief Justice Abbott, another one out of step. Was the jury packed in that case, too?
I shouldn't be surprised.
Well, your policy of making false allegations and sticking to them has certainly paid off. But they didn't at first. When you came out of prison, you moved a motion in the House against Lord Ellenborough. Are you suggesting that the House was packed?
Not at all. There were only 91 people there.
And all except Francis Burdett voted against you.
Many of them lived to regret it. You remember what I said then? It gives me great pleasure to repeat it.
Mr. Speaker, sir,
I said,
posterity will form a different judgment concerning my charges against Lord Ellenborough than that which has been adopted by this House. So long as I have a seat in this House, however, I will continue to bring them forward time after time, until I am allowed the opportunity of establishing the truth of my allegations.
What about that?
I grant you pretty well kept your word. Nearly all the books pronounce you innocent. Even from beyond the grave, you made your promise good.
No, you mustn't flatter me.
I don't intend to. You have some outstanding qualities. Fantastic courage, equal determination, brilliant seamanship, and loyalty to your own wife.
Oh, you make me blush.
But apart from those qualities, Lord Cochrane, you are a rascal.
What?
Lie your head off to secure your ends, but every now and then you slip up.
I've never denied making mistakes.
Forgery is hardly a mistake.
What do you say I forged?
The date of a letter.
I deny it?
Of course you do. But explain this if you can. You know that after he came out of prison, de Beringer published a book in which he admitted his guilt and said that you were equally guilty.
So you were. Do you not remember telling me to drive from Dover to Deal and knock up old Foley, the port admiral? Knock up old Foley and tell him the glorious news were your actual words. You liked the idea of making a fool of the admiral, but I demurred and compromised by writing to him instead. All right, I was. Old Foley told the court that he didn't believe a word of my letter, and if I'd gone to him, he'd have asked me questions which would have resulted in my immediate arrest and the failure of our plan.
At any rate, Lord Cochrane might have got off then. It was your calling on him with the object of obtaining civilian clothes that brought him into the picture.
True enough. And I called on him in red, not green. If I'd been in my sharpshooter's uniform, what need would I have had for civilian clothes?
I tell you, you came in green.
Well, let's forget the colors for the moment. After de Beringer had published his confession, you published a copy of a letter which you said he wrote to a solicitor on the 17th of February. 4 days before the fraud was committed.
Well, what of it? He did write that letter.
No doubt he did, but not on the 17th of February.
Well, I only had a copy of the letter, but the date on it was the 17th of February.
So you say. The whole point of your publishing the letter was that it was supposed to be written before the crime.
So it was.
If, in fact, it was written after the crime, it didn't help your case at all.
Well, what of it? It was sent on the 17th of February.
Let's see. In the middle of the letter, De Beringer said,
should the trial go against me, my fate is not bounded by disgrace and punishment only, for the doors of a prison will close upon me for life.
Hmm? What's that?
He said, should the trial go against me. What trial had he in mind on the 17th of February, 4 days before the crime was committed?
I don't remember that bit.
That's often the way, if you happen to forge a date. There, staring you in the face, is a passage which proves that the letter could not have been written until after De Beringer's arrest, and certainly not on the 17th of February before the crime.
Well, would I have been such a fool as to alter the date with that passage in front of me?
It's surprising what mistakes forgers make.
I am no forger.
But you put forward De Beringer's letter as being written on the 17th of February, and you founded your whole argument on that date.
Well, I made a mistake.
Indeed you did. A very unfortunate one, if you were innocent. Here are all the facts against you, quite enough of them. And now we find another. That you rely on a letter with a false date to try to prove your innocence.
My mistake about a date in no way proves my guilt.
Well, it's a very odd coincidence. But perhaps you were tricked into relying on the letter.
It's perfectly possible. My enemies would stoop to anything.
Let me ask you another thing. There's no doubt, is there, that you were a very keen sailor and a great patriot. You enjoyed fighting for your country.
Well, if that's a crime, I plead guilty.
I'm glad we've agreed on something. Just before the fraud, you've been ordered by the Admiralty to proceed to American waters in your ship, the Tonnant.
We can agree about that, too.
Good. We were then at war with America, were we not? Would I be right in thinking that when England was fighting, Lord Cochrane would like to be in the thick of the fight?
True, but it hardly becomes me to say so.
I will say it for you, then. Well, here was this war going on in American waters, and here were you, the gallant captain of Tonnant, ordered to proceed at once to the battle area. But instead of sailing as fast as you could, you asked the Admiralty for 14 days' leave in order to attend to a patent for a lamp. You asked to delay your sailing so that you could attend to a patent for a lamp.
Well, what about it?
How could a seaman of your keenness put off a day of battle for a mere lamp? Of course, if you'd wanted to take part in the stock exchange swindle, which might have made you a lot of money, your appetite for gain might have temporarily dulled your appetite for war. But a lamp, it's not possible.
Well, the Admiralty gave me leave.
Yes, I suppose they'd like to grant a captain's request if they can, but that's one thing. I cannot believe that the glorious Lord Cochrane, thirsting for battle, would be held up for a fortnight by a lamp.
You may believe what you like. I stayed behind to perfect a patent to a lamp. And it was in the factory where it was being made that I received the note from De Beringer.
The handwriting of which you couldn't read.
You keep on repeating yourself.
If I do, I'm only following your most successful lead. I thought I might give you a little of your own medicine. Then let's get back to your history. Your fortunes were at a very low ebb after the House had unanimously rejected your motion against Lord Ellenborough. But though you were down, you were not out.
Indeed, no.
You were determined to rehabilitate yourself and to make people believe that you were wrongly convicted.
That is certainly true.
So, you decided to prosecute Davidson. That was to be the start of your campaign. I was convicted on perjured evidence, you would have said. Unfortunately, that plan failed at the start, and on Davidson's acquittal, you must have been shaken. But nothing could stop a man of your determination. If you couldn't get over the wall, you'd get round it. And so you did. Off you went to Chile, Peru, and Brazil, and there you made yourself world famous. And this was the first step in the re-establishment of your character. In the House of Commons in July 1824, 10 years after your conviction, Sir James McIntosh said,
I know that I am here touching on a topic of great delicacy, but I must say that commerce has been gallantly protected by that extraordinary man who once filled a post in the British Navy at the brightest period of its annals. I cannot avoid fervently wishing that His Majesty's advisers will induce His Majesty graciously to return Lord Cochrane to the country which he so warmly loves, and to that noble service to the glory of which I am convinced he willingly would sacrifice every earthly consideration.
Oh, very charmingly put. But I still had a long way to go. Though I still had friends, I likewise had enemies. In 1828, after commanding the Greek Navy, I returned to England and began to campaign for my reinstatement.
You petitioned the Duke of Clarence, the Lord High Admiral, who later became William IV. He was the right sort of man for you. He loved giving things away. He infuriated the Admiralty by promotions and increases of pay till they forced him to go.
Exactly. The Admiralty were partly responsible for my conviction. They conspired with the others.
I suppose you mean that they gave you that 14 days leave in order to involve you in the stock exchange fraud.
Well, that could very well be.
Perhaps it was they who tricked you into buying £139,000 worth of stock, which you couldn't have paid for had there been a sudden fall.
Oh, no. I hadn't thought of that before. It's very possible.
And no doubt they employed de Beringer to take part in the fraud and involve you in it.
Wouldn't surprise me in the least.
Curious that when he came out of prison, he made no complaint of this.
Well, there's no accounting for the ways of foreigners.
Anyway, you petitioned the Duke of Clarence to seek a pardon for you from the king. The basis of your case on that occasion was that you were so conscious of your innocence that you were careless in preparing your defense.
So I was. So were my lawyers.
But in your petition, you took the blame mostly on yourself. And you complained, quite falsely, that you were refused a new trial because your uncle and McCrae were not present.
So I was.
Once again, your lie had a basis of truth. But in spite of the kindness of the Duke of Clarence and the mildness of your petition, it failed.
My enemies saw to that, but then God took a hand. George IV died and the Duke of Clarence became king.
That was indeed a godsend. You lodged a further petition. In that one, you attacked your lawyers but left the judges and jury and the stock exchange and the government out of it. When that petition was rejected, you played your trump card.
I did nothing of the sort. My wife suggested it herself. It was her idea that she should approach the king.
Well, we shall never know the truth about that. She was certainly a loyal and devoted wife. I take it you were happily married.
Yeah, 3 times.
I beg your pardon?
I said 3 times.
But I read of no divorce.
There was no divorce.
You weren't really married to them then. I must say, I didn't think you were that sort of man. I've always thought that one of the things in your favor was that you were a loyal and faithful husband.
So I was.
No, you're quibbling again. I'm not talking of your mistresses.
Nor am I.
Well, then, who did you first marry?
A lovely girl called Kitty Barnes, an orphan.
And next?
Lady Cochrane.
Well, of course, she became Lady Cochrane.
That was her name when I married her.
What an extraordinary coincidence. And the third?
Well, she became Lady Dundonald.
Well, of course, she did when you inherited the earldom. What was her name when you married her?
Lady Cochrane.
Oh, not another Lady Cochrane.
No.
Explain, please.
Quite simply. I married Kitty Barnes 3 times. In 1812, 1818, and 1825.
Were you separated in between?
Gracious, no. She'd have followed me to the ends of the earth, and I her.
So I believe. Then why marry her 3 times?
My family objected to the marriage. One of my uncles particularly wanted me to marry someone else. But I would have none of it. I took Kitty off to Scotland and married her in the Scottish form by declaration. She was only 16 then. In 1818, we had a religious marriage in England at the suggestion of my friends and relatives. And in 1825, one of my uncles, from whom I had expectations, insisted on our getting married again in the Scottish church. I'd have married her 4 times, if necessary. Any number of times. She was a wonderful woman, my Kitty. After my death, there was a family dispute which called my first marriage into question. Kitty had to give evidence before the House of Lords. Yeah. I wish I'd been there to hear her.
He was a glorious man. He was incapable of deception such as is imputed to him by the world. He was a god of a man. A hero of 100 fights. I have followed the fortunes of that great man. I have stood upon the battle deck. I have seen men fall. I have fired a gun for the honor of my husband and would do it again.
And that was by no means the greatest of her adventures. She risked her life more than once.
You were a fighting couple and you married for love.
Indeed we did. After the paper was signed in Scotland and the servants gone, he began to dance the sailor's hornpipe and said, "Now you are mine, Mouse, forever." He used to call me Mouse. And I said, "I have had no parson nor church. Is that the way you marry in Scotland?" "Oh, yes," he said, "you are mine, sure enough. You cannot get away. And I never wanted to. He was the most glorious man that God ever made.
Kitty believed in me through and through and insisted on going to see William IV. He granted her an audience. She was only just 35 and as lovely as ever. Lovelier, perhaps.
The king will see your ladyship now.
You are most kind, sir.
The Countess of Dundonald, sir.
Thank you, Gordon. Pray sit here, Lady Dundonald, where I can see you better. I said thank you, Gordon.
It is most kind of your majesty to grant me this interview.
Kindness makes the world go round, madam. I'm all for kindness. They thought I overdid it when I was Lord High Admiral. Promotions, you know, and that sort of thing. When the Admiralty got too cross with me, I just put to sea. Oh, we've one happy family there. The men all loved me. And next to the love of a woman, the respect and love of men is one of the highest of pleasures. I can't say that I was particularly kind to the Admiralty, but then they were certainly not kind to me. My poor old brother George couldn't understand it. You made me Lord High Admiral, I said. Then Lord High Admiral I'm going to be. I was right, wasn't I, Lady Dundonald?
Indeed, sir. My husband has always deeply admired your majesty and told me how the sailors loved you.
Has he indeed? Oh, that's very comforting. It's very difficult being a king. You never know what ordinary people are saying and thinking. That's why I like wandering about the streets and hearing it from themselves.
I hope, sir, that may be the reason why you have been gracious enough to see me.
Indeed, madam. But I must admit that I had seen your beauty at a distance, and I was determined to see it on its own.
You flatter me, sir.
No, no, Lady Dundonald, I never flatter. It is no kindness to flatter. If I say to a plain woman that she is lovely, she likes it for the moment, but when she gets home, she looks in the glass and thinks I must have been laughing at her. Well, if I can say something which will give her pleasure for certain, I will say it. But if her face were plain, I would ignore it. Fortunately, I have no difficulties at the moment. I can praise all of you. All that's visible, anyway.
May I tell you, sir, why I sought this audience?
Oh, if it will not end it too soon, you may...
It is about my husband.
Oh. Of course, yes. Your husband's a great seaman. We lack such on the quarterdeck. We need more of the Admiralty. Yes, it was a pity your husband had that little misfortune, but I shouldn't worry too much about it. Does he want promotion? He shall certainly have it.
It is reinstatement that he craves, sir. Reinstatement and pardon.
Pardon, eh? Oh, that's the first one I've been asked for since I succeeded. Well, you've come to the right man. It is enthroned in the heart of kings, I think it goes, and drops like dew, or is it rain? I can never remember. Dew doesn't drop, does it? Which dew say it is, Lady Dundonald?
Rain, sir, I think.
Well, rain or dew, it don't matter much. It's the mercy that counts.
May I tell you of my husband's case, sir?
Hmm?
He has been so much abused by his enemies.
I don't like having enemies. I've even made friends with the Admiralty. No malice, you see. I hate rows. I'm a peace lover.
That is why everyone loves you, sir.
Everyone? Oh, it would be nice to think so. Are you among the number?
My husband and I are two of your most devoted subjects, sir.
I asked about you, madam, not your husband. Do you love me?
As much as it becomes one of your subjects, sir.
Oh, to blazes with this word subject. I hate it. It suggests slaves and such things. I hope I haven't treated you as a slave, though I must admit that in some ways I should like to do so. But I've got to behave myself. My brother George wasn't always as good as he might have been, but that's all the more reason why I have to behave. Confounding nuisance. But there it is. The king can do no wrong, they say. Can't he? But he mustn't. Pray don't take it as an insult to your beauty.
You have been most kind, sir. And honorable.
Pity.
Might I mention my husband again, sir?
Your husband? Oh, yes, yes. Yes, you wanted him promoted or something.
You've read of his terrible case, sir, how his enemies brought him to ruin.
Yes, that's the trouble of having enemies. Tell him to have friends instead.
I had hope, sir.
Capital hope is better than reality. If all your hopes are fulfilled, you've nothing to live for.
I only live for one thing, sir. My husband.
Oh, lucky man. Though it could be a bit tedious for him. No, forgive me. That was a jest. I was thinking of wives who drape themselves round their husbands like fur. It's all right for a bit, but then it starts to close in on you. But you're not like that, I know. Oh, with you, I could... Come in.
Forgive me, Your Majesty, but the Prime Minister is waiting for an audience.
How aggravating. I was enjoying our talk, Lady Dundon.
It was good of you to see me, sir. And my husband's pardon, sir?
Oh, of course, yes. That's what you came about, was it not? What a shame. No one comes to see me for myself. They always want something. Never mind. It's rather nice to be able to give things away. Gordon?
Sir?
Remind me to arrange for a pardon for the Earl of Dundonald.
Yes, Your Majesty.
Oh, sir, you are too good.
Nobody regrets that more than I do, madam. Goodbye.
Well, Lord Cochrane, you got your pardon. But if I may say so, it was not because of your innocence, but in spite of your guilt.
Nevertheless, I got back to the Navy. And in 1848, I became Commander-in-Chief of the North American Station. Unfortunately, there wasn't a war on.
You were always at your best in a fight. I see that in 1854, you became one of the elder brethren of Trinity House, a very great honor.
Yes, I was pleased about that. I was almost 80 then. And a year later, I offered to serve in the Crimea War.
And you would have gone to.
If they'd let me. They thought me too old.
You certainly fought your way back. No one can fail to admire you for that. Though you did so by making one false statement after another, and as no one bothered to correct you, people began to believe you.
Well, they knew it was the truth.
They never thought about it.
My culminating triumph was being buried in Westminster Abbey.
Not your culminating one. You go on having triumphs. Not only did you impress your innocence on the people of your time, but nearly everyone who has written about you since your death proclaims your innocence.
Well, they recognize the truth.
Not at all. Some of them repeat your misstatements, and some add others for good measure. The two books which proved your guilt were just ignored.
And very properly. I would have done the same thing.
No doubt. The arguments against you are unanswerable, so no one tries to answer them. They just blandly repeat the myth of your innocence.
It is no myth.
No myth? I think you're forgetting one thing, my lord.
Huh. That's unlike me. What is it?
You are no longer on Earth. The standard of truth required where you are now is much higher than there.
Good gracious. I suppose you're right. I've been quite carried away. But it's your fault. You provoked me.
Well, Lord Cochrane, what is the truth?
The truth... The truth is... The truth... I... No, damn it! I tell you, I was not guilty. I was framed.
In A Matter of Speculation by Henry Cecil, adapted by the author from his book, the part of Admiral Lord Cochrane was played by Cecil Parker, and Mr. Gurney by William Fox. Sir Francis Burdett, Noel Howlett, De Berenger, Gerard Green, Lord Ellenborough, John Boxer, Mr. Adolphus, Alan Haynes, Le Marchant, Stephen Thorne, Crabb Robinson, Basil Jones, William Crane, Fraser Carr, Mr. Richardson, Nigel Graham, Andrew Cochrane Johnston, Eric Anderson, Sir James McIntosh, Hector Ross, Countess of Dundonald, Mary Wimbush, William the Fourth, Norman Shelley. Other parts were played by members of the BBC Drama Repertory Company. The play, which was recorded, was produced by Archie Campbell.